Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this Trust Company Town Hall Investment Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. If you require any assistance during the call, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference may be recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host of today's call, Mr. Ian Bruish. You may begin.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for joining the Trust Company's quarterly investment call. As a reminder, information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities product, service, or investment strategy. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing any strategy or recommendation discussed during this call. As you know, the Santa Ana Captiva Trust Company has divisions of the Naples Trust Company and Tampa Bay Trust Company. I'd like to take a quick moment to introduce the Naples Trust Company's new president, Wes McCann. Hello, Wes, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Ian. I'm delighted to be part of the Naples team and to be part of the Trust Company family. And thanks for the warm welcome.
Well, sure. And you have over 35 years of wealth management experience. In addition, I know you've served as managing director of your previous firm. You have many years of investment and portfolio management experience of your own, don't you?
Well, that's true, Ian. Like you, I'm a holder of the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. I've been a portfolio manager with several firms throughout the Southeast. And that's really why I appreciate the work that you, Tim, and the rest of our portfolio managers are doing here every day.
Well, great. With that, we'll pass it back to you so you can ask Tim and I the questions that our guests have sent in today.
Well, thank you, Ian, and good afternoon to both of you, sir.
Good afternoon, Wes.
Good to be with you both.
All right. So I've got questions lined up, and we're going to start with Tim. Can you give us your first impressions of the latest quarter, Tim?
I thought you were going to start me off with an easy one, Wes. I'm afraid the way the market's been moving, that whatever answer I give right now is going to be obsolete by tomorrow. But I know we've gotten a lot of questions about this kind of split personality that the market's been showing, you know, in this first quarter. Very uneven, very volatile day to day. We had several up weeks followed by a correction, and it just has perplexed a lot of investors, and it really has caused us to, you know, really pause and put a lot of thought into what's occurring. I mean, we had a lot of great economic and corporate news that filtered through the quarter, and to us it justified continued rally in the stock market, and then that great economic news was followed by a correction that started the end of January, when the market dropped about 11% in a matter of days, and it was a correction that really had no substantial cause. I mean, there were some things out of Washington that kind of stirred the pot. Interest rates had moved up. We had a few missteps by a few companies, but nothing that should have shaken the S&P 500 the way it did. And even today, after this jostling of more than a month, the S&P is still about 8% off its high, and I think the average stock in the S&P is about 15% off its high. So there's been a lot of, you know, internal damage just in a matter of weeks that we've had to just sit down and decipher. And I think as we end this quarter, we're seeing the same kind of fight going on within the market, the same kind of tug and pull, you know, between what the data is saying and what the mood and the reaction is saying on the other hand. And anytime we see this play out in the market, we know that ultimately the data wins out. So we're studying the information as it comes along, and the landscape still seems pretty positive to us.
Well, Ian, taking what Tim said there, there's certainly been a notable increase in volatility in the stock market since January. And, you know, what's your take on what's driving that volatility now?
Yeah, well, just a quick recap of 2018 so far. I mean, January was really pretty strong, really an extension of what we experienced in 2017. And then February, we got a bit of a sell-off, a correction in response to, I think, higher interest rates. But it wasn't just the move higher in interest rates. It was the pace at which they moved higher. You know, the 10-year Treasury moved up by about 30 basis points in a pretty quick period of time. Anytime that happens, that's going to cause some unease among market participants. We certainly saw that play out. More recently, I think there's been just a lot of noise around trade deals being renegotiated and the political posturing that comes with some of that around tariffs on certain industries. That's been in the headlines quite a bit, certainly caused some more uncertainty. Now, those are the causes, but I think it's also important to remind investors that 2017 was really an aberration in terms of volatility. The market was up 20 or so percent, but with very little day-to-day volatility. The market really moved steadily higher throughout the year. This year has certainly been more volatile, but from a historical standpoint, it isn't unusual at all.
That's interesting. Now, you know, as we concluded 2017 and began the year, things seem to be very positive, both with the economy and the way the markets are behaving, and then the correction occurs. Have investors really moved past all the positives that occurred last year?
Well, I think the thing to remember about the stock market is that it's always looking forward, and usually looking forward anywhere from 6 to 9 months. And what the market is saying right now is that there are worries about what may be happening late summer into the fall after the interest rate hikes, you know, and the market's starting to extrapolate or trying to extrapolate some of the news that's come out, you know, regarding trade tariffs and such. You know, and also earnings season is over. We had just stellar earnings out of S&P 500 companies and all the companies that we follow and put in portfolios. And then once all those companies reported their earnings, you know, the news cycle kind of went black, and the traders in the world had to rely on something day-to-day to hang their hats on, and they just start watching what's coming out of Washington, the pronouncements out of Europe. Any economic data point they can latch onto for a day becomes the news of the day and overrides what Apple or Microsoft or 3M might have reported 2 weeks earlier. So, you know, the market is trying to digest all this, and it's right now trying to make some new assessments as to what, you know, the factors that Ian pronounced, you know, are going to impact the market in the future. You know, we've had turnover in the White House in terms of new appointments. We've had trade pronouncements. We've had worries that the economy may have peaked and can't get any, you know, better than it's been showing right now. We have the spike in interest rates, and the market's just trying to assess that and trying to extrapolate 6 to 9 months in advance and seeing how to reevaluate companies.
You know, Ian, as Tim was reflecting on the market's forward-looking nature there, he discussed items that could drive us further towards correction, as people theorize. Would that be a situation that you would consider automatically raising cash for?
No, we typically do not manage anything much differently as a result of a correction. You know, we know that corrections are actually a healthy market dynamic that occur, I think, more often than people realize within an otherwise healthy upward trending market. So from our standpoint, there's really no need to make quick or rash judgments based on short-term market movements. It's just an understanding that they're going to happen. Now, what we've experienced in February and March of this year, we haven't really felt for the better part of 2 years. So I think it's normal for people to feel a little uneasy. We're all, you know, we all remember 3 to 6 months in the past. Much beyond that, it gets a little cloudy. So I think, you know, this more near-term market movement that we've seen is certainly not something we're gonna change. Now, just from an investment standpoint in terms of how we approach things, we usually use corrections as a way to spend further cash among the investments we've been wanting to either add to or purchase, make initial purchases in any way. So that's typically how we manage around that.
Okay. Tim, Ian reflected on a moment ago about the trade war and some of the tariffs. How would you look at Trump's tariffs and the impact that may have on the economy and stock prices?
Well, I have to smile there because we've been following Mr. Trump here now for 15 months, and we like to think that his pattern now is really to announce an out-of-the-box solution or diagnosis and then see who comes to the table and comes back with a response, and eventually we hope that there's a negotiated settlement between all the parties somewhere in the middle, and we hope that this, you know, what's happening with the trade talk the last couple of weeks ends up that same way. You know, we also look at it from the point of view that we've been in a trade war. The media's propping that up right now, but really since about 2011, 2012, there's been a just unannounced trade war around the world when a lot of other countries ran up big budget deficits, ran their interest rates to near zero, and tried to cheapen their currencies, which really started hurting American producers who were exporting. And we started seeing the sales and earnings growth of a lot of our companies fall. We started to see the value of our exports fall. Our economy nearly stalled and went into a recession in 2015 and early 2016 when, you know, the value of, you know, many foreign currencies had fallen 20 to 25% against the dollar. And we had been losing that trade war. Well, that's kind of reversed now, and we've been winning it since 2016. So anything coming out of Washington right now seems like a belated knee-jerk response to, you know, what has already been softening. You know, I would say this, that all the companies that we invest in are generally helped by free trade and open borders, you know, whether that's Apple and Home Depot, you know, trying to source cheaper materials over in Asia, or it's 3M or Honeywell trying to get a level playing field in Europe so they can sell goods in all those countries, or even Microsoft when it's trying to source, you know, qualified candidates and get visas for them so they can come in and work for Microsoft. Our countries benefit by this free trade. And having said that, we just think that what's coming out of Washington right now is, so far, it's going to be a blip. The dollar amounts that are attached to these tariffs that are coming from China and the United States and possibly from Europe, they're going to be a blip on the economy. It doesn't look like this is going to be something that can escalate. And I think it's just way too premature to extrapolate that this is going to just escalate into something that we saw in the 1920s or 30s.
Hmm. Well, you know, that's interesting with all the news around trade wars and now the increase in volatility. Ian, I'm curious on your perspective about how you think that could change the way we look at the economy in 2018, and particularly, do you think we still have a good likelihood of hitting the 3% GDP growth that people in Washington have been predicting?
Yeah, I think we can. I mean, first off, we're basically there already, running right around that level. There certainly isn't anything within the economic data that we look at that suggests otherwise. And those data points that I mentioned are GDP, inflation, housing, production, consumption, unemployment levels. They happen to all be trending in fairly positive directions. You couple that with corporate and revenue earnings growth, that remains quite positive. And then we also have to remind ourselves of the added benefit of corporate tax reform, which is new, and that's going to obviously work in favor of the broader economy as well. That certainly should go a long way to help boost GDP growth. So overall, I certainly think 3% is achievable, and I think we've mentioned in the past, we continue to be pretty constructive on the broader U.S. economy.
Well, that's encouraging to feel that constructive thought about the economy. So what are the surprises that would worry you that might derail that direction?
Yeah, I think the one worrisome sign is the one economic data point that we have to watch, particularly this year and in the next year, is interest rates and their movement. Will they move higher? How fast is that going to happen? Volatility within interest rates, that's really what we're looking to this year and next in terms of risks. Now, I also point out that it's not just the pace at which interest rates are going to move. It's also just the shape of the yield curve. We know that the Fed recently raised interest rates recently here in March. And what we've noticed just in the past week, it's a fairly new dynamic. If we would have had this call a week ago, we wouldn't have said this. But we've seen another flattening, a round of flattening in the yield curve. So the 10- and the 30-year yields have been coming down in response to what the Fed did, which is to raise the short end. So there has been some flattening in the yield curve, and that matters because we know that when the yield curve flattens or inverts, that tends to be bad for stock markets. So it's certainly something we're watching pretty closely. Nothing to be alarmed by yet, but something definitely as an investment professional we have to keep our eye on.
Mm-hmm. Tim, we've had a fair amount of discussion now on the U.S. economy. Getting outside of the U.S. and looking overseas, how do you feel about what's going on around the globe?
Well, this is probably the first synchronized global expansion that we've seen in probably 11 or 12 years. It's not just happening in the United States. It's happening in Canada and Mexico and South America. And, you know, you could go country by country, and you're seeing positive signals that really align with what we're seeing in the United States. I mean, industrial production is growing in India and China and Brazil, even in Japan. I saw last week China cut taxes to consumers and businesses by another $125 billion. That's going to be stimulative to their economy. And in response, our own factories are increasing production just to serve the buyers of their goods overseas. You know, and they're ramping up production for exports, and this is all feeding on itself. And right now this looks like the type of expansion that can still accelerate, and it certainly doesn't look like an expansion or an economic condition that's peaking, because we're not seeing any signs that global growth is peaking right now. And it looks like all the central bank stimulus that has been attempted since 2009 really is finally taking hold. And I'm talking about the stimulus from our own Federal Reserve, from the Bank of Japan, from the Bank of England, the European Central Bank. They've been able to engineer finally a synchronized growth, and they've done this without a lot of inflationary pressures. So it really is what we'd like to call a Goldilocks situation, and it's feeding itself, and it's really starting to help our businesses that we're investing in.
Well, Ian, that's a lot of positive news, and as we think about positive economic news, oftentimes what comes with that is the potential for interest rates to increase as economic activity heats up. You're on record for thinking that we're going to have more increases in this year of 2018. How many more increases do you think we're likely to see, and how fast might they come?
Yeah, I think my expectation is really just based on what I think most market participants expect, which is two more rate hikes this year and then three more next year. So that's a total of three in 2018 and three in 2019. And that's certainly consensus in terms of what most people expect. So the Fed just raised rates this past month here in March, and they're on pace to do it twice more before the end of the year. I think certainly, you know, to your point, if the economy continues to progress ahead, I think the Fed will have the latitude to continue to raise on schedule. Now, certainly, if we are surprised by some event or if corporate earnings and profits don't come in as positive as we think, if we get a massive sell-off in one asset market or another, it can certainly cause the Fed to kind of put those rate hikes on pause. And, you know, just given their movements over the last few years, the Fed has moved slower than anticipated the last several years. More recently, they've been really kind of sticking to the plan of raising. But, you know, they hold the cards. They can decide to, if two doesn't make sense, they can certainly skip one. And that would just prolong the pace at which we move to higher rates. But broadly speaking, over the next few years, I think most people at this point agree interest rates are going higher. It's just a matter of how soon or how quickly that will happen.
Ian, we're continuing with another question on interest rates. And, you know, with a rising rate environment, we're getting questions that tie back to the role of bonds in an investor's portfolio, whether it be for income or safety. And what's your viewpoint on how active we should be with bond holdings now?
Yeah, I think, our decisions around how much or how heavily we want to allocate to bonds, we're a ways away from adding bonds to client accounts in a meaningful way. So I think it still makes sense to add bonds for volatility reduction, but as a way to, boost risk-adjusted returns, we're still a ways off. In our opinion, stocks still offer a much better risk-adjusted value over bonds, despite the fact that we recognize that interest rates are modestly higher than they have been in the past. So we're still a ways away, I think, from considering bonds in a really meaningful way. But we also recognize it's sort of a sliding scale. It's not as if we're going to wake up one morning and decide that 30 or 40% of bonds make sense. It's just going to happen over time. And we have these discussions internally about our strategies pretty often, particularly our income-producing strategies. There will certainly be a day when bonds play a much bigger role for our income, for our clients that require or need income. And frankly, we welcome that change. I think for years we've been waiting for higher interest rates. I'll speak on behalf of Tim and the rest of the portfolio managers. I know we'd love to be able to get 4, 5, 6% on some good quality corporate bonds, but we're just not there yet.
Okay. Now, Tim, I think I heard mentioned earlier a comment on the new tax bill. Tell me how you think that's going to continue to impact stock prices and how are companies responding to the new tax bill?
I think investors are going to see the impact in two phases, and phase one has already occurred. The bill was passed, and the market, bid companies higher, as it should have. And when we look back and see the reaction to the market to the tax bill being passed, the reactions were pretty efficient. Corporations whose tax rates were going to fall the most, that is from 35% down to 21, saw the biggest boost to their stocks, and that would be, small banks in the United States, small cap companies, companies that don't export, retailers. Companies, their customer base is 100% in the United States. We also saw that the big multinational corporations who are already gaming the tax system around the world and paying much lower than a 35% rate, we're not going to see as big a boost, and their share prices didn't boost. Didn't see that boost. Phase two is now upon us, and phase two is when we look and see how companies are finally going to take advantage of the fact that they're not paying Uncle Sam as much money as they were even 3 months ago. We've already seen companies increase wages, pay bonuses, add to their pension funds, that were underfunded. I think those are good uses. They're going to benefit, their internal employees. And they're at the point now where they can start spending a lot of money to benefit shareholders. They're going to hike their dividends. We think of companies like Apple, which has substantial capacity now to hike its dividend now that's repatriating $250 billion from overseas. We have companies that can expand now and have extra cash flow to expand operations. And we certainly have the capacity now to buy back a lot of stock. Corporations have been doing this for the last 3 or 4 years, and in 2017, I think the S&P 500 companies bought back $520 billion worth of stock. They paid out another $400 billion in dividends. So they were returning already before this tax bill passed almost $1 trillion to investors to raise share prices and share values. And now they've just gotten an extra windfall that we think is just going to put a few $100 billion per year back in shareholders' pockets. And this is where we're going to see kind of phase two of the effects.
Interesting. Ian, continuing with the changes in the tax law, one of the popular income investments of the past years has been master limited partnerships. And, of course, the tax law is going to have an impact there. Do you think master limited partnerships are going to be less attractive as an income investment following?
Well, in short, no. I mean, MLPs, master limited partnerships, MLPs have really been affected more recently by a FERC ruling, a FERC decision, and FERC just stands for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That's the group that regulates interstate pipelines. They're no longer going to be able to recover an income tax allowance in some of their cost of business rates, which sort of a very specific technical change that will affect cash flows, I think, very modestly across the board. But when the news hit, we did experience a pretty rapid sell-off in some of these names. However, it's, you know, in our belief, it's our belief that the short-term reactions have been just considerably overblown, in our opinion. The companies we follow, we're not really expecting any material impact to their financials, and in many cases, they're not even planning any changes to their upcoming financial guidance at all. So for those reasons, I mean, I think the ruling hasn't really made these less attractive, in our opinion. They remain fundamentally sound businesses with now even more attractive current income yields. So what was yielding 5 or 6%, we're seeing many of these really good companies yielding 7 to 8%.
Interesting. So, Tim, we've had several questions come in about this. It shouldn't be any surprise given the news. It's the Facebook question. You know, given the issues going on with its data security issues, how do you see this problem and this situation unfolding?
Well, Wes, we've put Facebook in a lot of growth accounts, so we watch it very closely. And, in fact, when this news broke last week, we had, you know, the investment team, our own Facebook powwow for a morning, and we just played devil's advocate and just sliced and diced the company from all different directions to see what the, you know, broader impacts were going to be of this data breach that occurred. You know, the first thing that occurred to us was this was really being trumped up literally and figuratively in the media because there was a connection to the Trump campaign and the fact that Facebook sold data to a company that passed it on to another company that used it to mine, you know, folks for the election in 2016. That's the business model of Facebook. We get that. We understand it. And if you're investing in Facebook, you're investing in a company that basically sells the data of all the people who, you know, put their information on their website. Their business model works. It's growing at a rapid clip. And really what we have to do is judge whether this type of data breach is going to cause such a fundamental change to their business model that, you know, Facebook is no longer going to be an attractive investment. And we just saw this as, first of all, nothing new because they're going to be facing these types of situations and recriminations from the government in the future. We know that there's going to be further regulation coming down the pipe from both the United States and particularly in the European Union. And we know that Facebook is going to have to put on more restrictions of its data. That is clear to us. And we're going to be keeping an eye on, you know, what the fines are going to be and whether or not any sort of recriminations are going to cause a big adjustment to their business model. And that's going to show up first really in what we call the user engagements and, you know, the role that advertisers play in supporting Facebook. If we see that fewer people are going on the site and spending less time on it, if we see many, many advertisers pulling out, if we see that new money is not flowing into Facebook from advertisers who want to get into the digital space, you know, to sell their products, that's a fundamental adjustment we'll make to Facebook. So we haven't resolved this issue right now. We just think that what has happened right now is a fixable problem. It got blown up because of the political implications. But beyond that, it just puts us on notice that we have to watch Facebook a lot closer.
Well, let's continue with that for a second, Tim. I mean, data security is on everybody's mind now after the Facebook fiasco. Is that likely to bleed over elsewhere into other companies, particularly Google?
Well, it probably already has bled into Google because we've seen that stock fall almost as much as Facebook ever since both of them peaked a few weeks ago. you know, no doubt those are the two 800-pound gorillas in digital advertising. I think they control about 65 to 70% of all digital advertising dollars, and new money that gets poured into digital advertising generally gravitates only to those two companies. That's how powerful they are, and that's one of the things we look at, and one of the reasons we liked both companies is that if you're selling a product in the digital age, you have to use Google and Facebook. There's almost no other source that can get you the return on your investment dollars, and that gives us kind of that fundamental moat that we like with companies. You know, on the other hand, we know this is a privacy issue, and government likes to take very keen interest in privacy matters. So we are already discounting the fact that Google and Facebook are going to face more regulation, more privacy, you know, concerns. Certainly there will be blowback that could last a couple of years, but we also think the market has discounted this already. Google and Facebook are both growing at well over 20% a year, and yet their stocks are only trading, I think, at, you know, 21 or 22 times forward earnings. When I say forward, it means 2018 earnings. You know, under that situation, these stocks look pretty attractive, and they're priced based on the fact that they are going to be more regulated in the future.
Yeah, and Tim mentioned earlier that all of the earnings have come through for the quarter and been reported. What's your take on how you looked at the way the company earnings came in?
Yeah, well, overall, we were really pleased with the fourth quarter earnings announcement. There's always exceptions, but overall, it was quite positive. Dick Pyle out on Sanibel maintains an internal stat for us as a group, and he tracks the number of companies on our approved list that either meet or exceed their expectations each quarter. That number came in at around 81% for the fourth quarter. Now, more normally, that's right around 60%. So clearly, just across the board, it was a pretty strong quarterly earnings season. And then I think, you know, that generally portends well for the future, another reason why we're feeling pretty confident about the remainder of the year and the economic growth we're experiencing.
And Tim, do you think these companies are going to be able to continue that same momentum going into the March and the June quarters as the year unfolds?
Well, earnings are tied to sales, and sales tend to be tied to economic growth or GDP. And right now the GDP numbers, both here and abroad, look like they can sustain themselves at current levels. And if that's the case, I would expect more sales momentum out of our companies. I was real pleased in the December quarter when they all reported that the companies we put in folks' portfolios, I think, collectively grew their sales about 8% year over year. And that is 2.5 times the rate of the economy. And that is really the fastest growth rate we've seen from these same companies since about 2011. So a lot of positive things are happening. And if the economic data continues to show and trend the way it has trended, I think the March and June quarters are going to be pretty positive as well.
You know, that's a lot of positive economic news, and yet with this increase in volatility, we've seen particularly the high-yielding stocks under a lot of pressure and behaving poorly. Ian, you know, walk us through how you feel about the high-yielding stocks. Is this strictly an interest rate issue? So.
I think the interest rate issue is clearly the 800-pound gorilla. I mean, that is why higher-yielding stocks have underperformed more recently. Anytime you get a move higher in interest rates, you're going to get a little bit of a sell-off in income-producing stocks. We have to remember that for years, you know, we've been dealing with exceedingly low historical interest rates. Dividend-paying stocks, preferred stocks, REITs, master limited partnerships, income-producing stocks have been an alternative to bonds for many people. So, you know, if you're getting a move higher in those bond yields, now they just represent a better, a more competitive alternative to what people have been using. So I do think that's a huge impetus behind some of these higher-yielding stocks having a tough first quarter. Longer term, though, we have to remember that many of these dividend-paying stocks, not only do they have a dividend, but they're also growing their revenue and their earnings. So let's not get too caught up in short-term, month-over-month price movements. These are still solid businesses.
Okay. Hey, Tim, I've seen in recent presentations you've been showing information that discusses that stock indexes were really being led by just a few companies. Can you extrapolate on that and describe that?
Yes, what I was pointing out was that the Dow Jones Industrials and the S&P, despite having very stellar years last year, were really being led by a small handful of companies, and it really distorted to the upside, and it can distort to the downside, you know, the returns of the market, and give a false impression that we have broad-based sell-offs or broad-based, rallies the market, and it also distorts the way you look at your own portfolio versus these companies. And, you know, as an example, in the Dow Jones Industrial, I think Boeing alone contributed 20% of the entire gain of the Dow last year, and you throw in Caterpillar and United Healthcare and I think McDonald's, and they contributed almost 60% of the Dow's entire gains. And these are just four or five stocks. And the S&P similarly was led by Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft. You know, this year alone, I think they've contributed about 45% of the gain that occurred in January, and they've accounted for 45% of the decline. So if you don't own those five or six stocks within those indexes, or if you don't have a portfolio built around those types of companies, you're likely have done fine, and you're not experiencing those types of distortions. So we're looking at that, and it's giving us pause, really, to make broad-based assumptions about what the indexes are doing and where they're going to go, because there is that kind of leadership anomaly right now.
All right, well, we're going to conclude with one question for both of you, and that is, this has been a lot of positive news. There's a lot of reasons to feel good about the economy and the way our portfolios are positioned, but what is it that keeps you up at night? What is it that's going to worry you most that could underplay what we're doing?
Well, I'll take that one first. I've been in this business long enough to know the adage that you don't fight the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and what they're doing with monetary policy, and you don't fight them, when they're lowering interest rates and just pushing asset prices higher, and you don't fight them when they're aggressively raising interest rates because that can undercut valuations. And to that extent, I would echo Ian's comments earlier that if rates move up too much and too fast, it's going to cause a lot of dislocations in the financial markets. You're certainly going to see losses in the bond markets. You'll probably see the U.S. dollar surging, as a result of our interest rates rising too fast. That would have problems for the earnings of corporate America. You would see, P/E ratio contractions. Companies trading at 20 times earnings would suddenly trade at 16 or 17 times earnings. It might slow the economy down if it did that. It could increase government deficits at the state and local and federal level. At the same time, their interest costs would rise. There's a whole host of problems that could spin off if rates moved up too fast. So I don't mean to be gloom and doom and saying that could happen, but you ask what would worry me the most. I think the Fed is astute enough not to let that happen. But
yeah, and I just quickly add that I think Tim's right on in terms of the pace at which interest rates may rise, but also the shape of the yield curve really matters. The Fed really only controls the short end of the yield curve. They can raise short-term rates, and then the market, supply and demand for Treasury bonds, whether they be 5, 10-year, 30-year bonds, is really just dictated by the market. And we have seen some flattening more recently. Again, nothing to be concerned about overly at this point, but nonetheless something we're certainly watching.
That's great, guys, and I appreciate you letting me sit in on that today. So.
Yeah, thanks, Wes.
Thanks, Wes. We enjoyed it.
All right, well, this concludes the Trust Company's quarterly investment call. If we weren't able to address your question today, please feel free to contact your investment advisor to discuss it further. If there's anything we can do to assist you at the Sanibel Captiva Trust Company, Naples Trust Company, or Tampa Bay Trust Company, please contact us. Thank you again for joining us today, and have a great afternoon.